Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
You know, Brian, I've noticed the older you get, the fewer movies you want to keep. By the time you get my age, you only want to keep one or two. Would you agree?
I don't remember this from The Hurt Locker. Is this from The Hurt Locker?
It's one of the most important scenes in the movie. Come on. Do you get an adrenaline rush from kicking movies? Is that
I do not
a better one for you?
No, I feel very badly whenever I kick a movie.
Man, both of my setups really fell there, so I'm just going to just go straight to saying BPT is a drug, and that today's movie is The Hurt Locker, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. Here's the trailer.
Welcome to Camp Victor.
Oh, Camp Victory? I thought this was Camp Liberty.
Oh, no, they changed that about a week ago. Victory sound better.
All right.
So what do you got?
The car has been parked illegally. The suspension is sagging. There's definitely something heavy in the trunk.
Interesting.
What's he doing?
I'm gonna die. I wanna die comfortable.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
873.
873?
You're a wild man, you know that?
Hello, so bad. First time working together. What do you think?
I think us working together means I talk to you and you talk to me.
Are you going on a date, Sanborn?
My team leader is inspiring. He's going to get me killed.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That was good.
What do we have here?
This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
Put down the phone!
Burn him out, drive!
I can't get a shot!
I was scared.
Yeah?
Well, everyone's a coward about something.
We're going on a mission. My job is to keep you safe so we can keep going on mission.
It's combat, buddy.
Go!
Everybody get back!
Go, go, go!
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
Found something.
You roll the dice. And you deal with it.
Oh, boy.
I still remember the first time when I took my headset off and you punched me in the face. Remember that in the first episodes of Best Picture This?
Yeah, I didn't stand for that. We're a team. We got to work together.
The Hurt Locker won Best Picture. It won Best Directing. Kathryn Bigelow, the first woman to win Best Director for an Oscar. It also won for Best Original Screenplay, Mark Boll. Best Film Editing, Mixing, Editing, or Sound Editing, that is. This is before they blended the sound mixing and the sound editing, you know. It was also, Jeremy Renner was nominated for Best Actor. How do you feel about that?
I think he's really good.
I think he's really good too. I'd have to look at the list again and remember. Barry Aykroyd nominated for cinematography and then original score. So it was made for $15 million and it made $49.2 million. It's a pretty bad showing for a Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
As far as the overall box office, it still tripled its budget. In the United States, The Hurt Locker is only one of five Best Picture winners to never enter the weekend box office top five since 1982, I should say.
The timeliness working against it in this case, you think?
I don't know.
People don't want to
I don't think so. I think timeliness is often a good thing. With war movies, I don't know.
I would think relevancy is definitely a good thing, but when it comes to a war, it could be that people aren't ready to face it at a certain point, and
could be.
A movie like this might suffer.
The English Patient was one of the other five that never made the top five. Amadeus, which is ridiculous. Should have been number one on the box office. The Artist and The Shape of Water never made the top five. The screenplay was written by Mark Bull, as I mentioned. He was a freelance writer embedded as a journalist in 04, and he kind of like compiled all these different true life things into one movie, which made some people mad, including the guy who said war is a drug and was basically the Jeremy Renner guy. But he like he filed a lawsuit, and it wasn't pretty. But Mark Bull ended up winning because he went in with this agreement with the Department of Defense that he could like, you know, use what he found there. And he happened to find stuff that people said and all
and
that.
And did he use real names?
No, he didn't use real names.
I don't see what the problem is, but it's our classic scenario, our classic debate here about real and
oh, there's plenty of debate about real versus not real in this movie. One note that I thought would be interesting. I know that you like this type of thing. The film had not recovered its budget by the time of the Oscars. So it was at $15 million budget. It was less than $15 million. And remember, it didn't do too well in the box office, never made the top five. But apparently the Oscars gave it a boost, and it soared beyond the 15 to hit $49 million. So that's a pretty big, big boost. How do you feel about the Oscars giving such a financial boost?
It's not really surprising. I'm looking it up. Unless this is wrong, this came out in June. So yeah, I mean, it had a really long time to make that money and made only less than $15 million before, you know, the what pre... February Oscar push. So kind of a flop.
Yeah, I'd say so. But apparently the Academy enjoyed it still. Rotten Tomatoes, 97. Even more impressive. Metacritic, 95.
Even more impressive.
But more important, even more impressive. At the Venice International Film Festival in 2008. It got a 10-minute standing.
Okay. All right. That's how you know.
That's a 10 out of 10. Yeah. That's the max standing O that they will allow before they say, everyone sit back down. It's 10 minutes. Okay. You got there. It's the second highest rated film from critics of 09 behind Up. And it was on 15 major publications. It was number one on 15 major publications' top movies. Ebert made it. Gave it the second best film of the decade behind, of course, Synecdoche, New York, number one for the decade for Ebert. Interesting.
Okay.
Doesn't that make you want to watch it one more time?
I've seen it a lot of times. I like it. You know, it's not, I don't dislike it.
I saw it once.
It wouldn't be my number one.
Not for the decade?
No.
Okay. So coming up in the show, questions, we'll do trivia and we will keep and or kick.
I also think it's interesting. I didn't know that the screenwriter Mark Bull was a journalist before this. It makes sense. But he and Bigelow reunited 4 years later for Zero Dark Thirty, which I didn't realize it was the same team behind that movie. Kind of cool.
I think also, I could be wrong on this, so maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'm pretty sure that the cinematography was same guy who did United 93, which also... Okay. Right after it happened, you know, it's very immediate. So anyway.
Yeah. Timeliness in that case, 9/11, it's working against you, I think.
I went into United 93.
You saw it when it came out?
No. I just saw it like several months ago for that year, whatever year it came out. And I thought that the super documentary feel worked really well for me.
Yeah, but you're watching it 20 years removed.
It's true.
From the event. You know, watching it a couple years after would probably be a lot harder.
See, Casablanca came out during World War II, so I just saw
and that is a real depiction.
It's a documentary style, you know, love story.
All right, so Ed Koch of The Atlantic, I think it's Koch, it might be Coke. The Hurt Locker is without a doubt one of the best pictures, war pictures I've ever seen, and I've seen most of them, he said. Jeanette Katsuis of Reverse Shot, she said, more than anything, The Hurt Locker is a high-wire study of men at work, its lack of overt politics replaced by a revelatory central performance. So first of all, I want to acknowledge the men at work thing.
I was going to say, I like that.
Yeah, because you've kind of been looking for movies about people making a living. People, this one isn't that necessarily.
People doing their jobs.
But it is definitely about jobs, about people going in and being good at their jobs and carrying it out.
I guess war movies are kind of people about doing their jobs. Not exactly how I would think about, but
yeah, some of them are. But yeah, it keeps the focus really tightly on this unit of people doing work. And so I wondered how that focus, without the movie kind of going global, contributes to Koch's point of importance. You know, is the movie more or less important by ignoring politics? What do you think?
Well, as a enduring work of art, I kind of tend to think that if you are less stressed about the politics, then it's better. Sort of like Up in the Air, you know, we talked about, you know, how much did that bother you or factor in the fact that it's all about, you know, it was so timely about the economy, the crash, everybody's losing their jobs. And then here's a movie about people getting fired and how they're getting fired. But yet, you know, I feel like Shakespeare is a perfect example to the contrary, because in so many plays, like even in Hamlet, I've been watching the Kenneth Branagh 4-hour, every word that Shakespeare wrote for the play is in this version. Part of what they always cut out of Hamlet for a shortened, like 2-2.5 hour version is all the politics, you know, Fort and Brass of Norway, you know, all these other different angles. There's very little of that in most of the, you know, for production kind of versions. And Kenneth Branagh includes all that. Shakespeare does it all the time, where there's like this extra layer of significance and gravitas to it because the geopolitical, you know, tension on top of the tragedy. So I guess if Shakespeare can do it, then maybe it is a good thing. But I think that like we've talked a lot. I think we're at odds so often, you know, with these movies, but sometimes I think one thing that we both kind of appreciate is like the kind of close, intimate character study is often the most emotionally impactful.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that the focus is so much like that in this movie is one of the pluses of the movie for sure.
For sure. I don't think that it feels like an anti-war movie because of that.
I don't feel like it's anti-war either. I mean, war is a drug at the same time. I mean, it's doing both. It's like how horrible it is, but also, you know,
I think it is an anti-war movie. I just think it doesn't necessarily feel like that. It's kind of more about how war and the acts of war change people, changes their brain chemistry. You know, I think about toward the end of this movie with Renner in the grocery store, and now he's back at home, back in the States, and his wife tells him to get some cereal. And he's like looking at this line of hundreds of boxes of cereal, and you kind of get this impression of it's hitting him how menial this task is, how low stakes this decision is in his life. He's cleaning out the gutters. This is all in comparison to him, you know, trying to defuse bombs before they blow up and kill battalions, you know? And I think that combined with just how we see them interact with Iraqis, it just tells me so much more about how war affects these people than, you know, sort of focusing on the misery and the atrocities would.
Yeah. It's kind of sad how seriously I do take my cold cereal choices. I mean, that is a big moment in the grocery store.
Well, you have your different kinds of cereal. You have your breakfast cereal, the healthy ones.
No, it's all the same.
You're telling me another you eat sugar cereals for breakfast?
I had Cocoa Pebbles today, this morning.
That's a dessert cereal. Everybody knows that.
Okay, so there's, again, thinking about the significance of the character study value of the movie. So when they're assigned to destroy the explosives, which is throughout the movie, but Jeremy Renner goes back and says, "Oh, I forgot my gloves." And he just drives down there where they're doing the practice explosives.
Yeah.
And Sanborn, Anthony Mackie, is like, "I could accidentally push this button and blow him up." That was one moment where I couldn't decide if this was like perfectly ambivalent and like, it's like, wow, I don't know which way he's going to go, or if it just wasn't really pulled off like I kind of wished that it was. Did you think that he might actually push the button, or was there 1% chance, 0%, 50-50?
For the movie, 0% chance. I did not think they were going to kill Renner.
Yeah.
But I had a similar reaction to you watching this scene again, because I was kind of torn in between thinking, this feels very written. All of a sudden, yes, he's considering killing this, yeah, guy. That would be a really extreme step to take. But then I would argue with myself, you know, and I would say, well, they are in war. This guy is putting their lives at stake. And Sam Bourne is very, very structured, and he's, yep, very aware of structured Renner is. And so when you just kind of introduce this sort of loose cannon into a very tight-knit group, it's like, how long is it going to take before that has fatal impacts on somebody, yeah, on their team? And so
I'm right there with you.
I went back and forth and back and forth.
All that. So where did you land?
Is
it a plus moment in the movie, or a neutral or a negative moment to you as far as like the movie making?
I think that it's an interesting scene, and in that I got tripped up on it, you got tripped up on it. And did I ever think that he was going to kill him? No, but I like that I'm wrestling with these ideas, yeah, during it and thinking he's not going to do it. This does seem like this happened fast, but I can understand what the motivations would be behind.
I mean, we saw the trailer. That. We know Jeremy Renner is in it for the rest of the movie. So yeah, obviously he didn't kill him. So I had a similar wrestle. This is, I said to you earlier that my relationship with the Hurt Locker became more complicated this time around. Mm-hmm. I think the first one or two times I watched it, I think this is the third time I've seen it, I was like, movie of the year. Boom, right there. And this time around, for some reason, that moment kind of tripped me up a little bit. And so did Jeremy Renner. I mean, I love the interactions with the kid who's selling him the movie. You know, he's treating him like a little brother and even like a son. You know, we find out that, you know, he has his own son. When he believes that kid, that Iraqi kid, is, you know, on the table and he's been mutilated, basically, the way he kind of loses it and then his mental state is so disrupted that he takes his buddies into another dangerous, you know, zone, you know, shortly thereafter in the movie. I was a little bit wrestling there too with like, okay, is this guy like almost like psychopath, no emotion? He's cold, he's got ice water in his veins, all that. And he's going to go and defuse bombs? Or does he have a cracking point and does he have some humanity to him? I feel like they spent a lot of the movie showing like he's almost like an alien, like he has no fear. And then here, I couldn't tell if it was totally earned by the movie or if it was a little bit written, like we want this character to change, so here's when it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Do you know where you see where I'm coming here?
I definitely do. It's another situation where you kind of see a character spike in an extreme way.
I want movies to surprise me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'm like, that surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like there was some percentage of melodrama with the way it was done.
Yeah. You mean with him kind of going into a village and
snapping like because of his son, and he's sort of conflating his own son back home and he's conflating this kid here and he thinks it's that kid. I don't like to come on the podcast and then like criticize.
I don't think great you're criticizing
work of art.
Though you're,
I'm
you're,
trying not to wrestle with
yeah
it.
You're working through
thank you
whether
thank
or
you.
Not this feels like a believable character choice, yep, and you're trying to understand your emotions.
I am,
and these
I'm
conversations
wrestling.
Are like therapy sessions for us, right? Every time I talk about a movie, I do kind of think about it in that way, like I'm trying to sort of figure out,
yeah,
what exactly do I feel about those.
I'm not coming here with golden takes anymore. I'm coming here to understand myself.
I think that's fair. Yeah. And I think that that's the right way to approach any kind of artistic endeavor, Brian. Hmm. Peter Bradshaw of The Guardian, he called The Hurt Locker a blazingly powerful action movie whose unpretentious clarity makes for a refreshing change. And I wanted to bring this up because this is definitely an action movie. And
it
in the
is.
Trailer, you're hearing that like, hard rock and roll, we're going into war. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of crunchy guitar riffs and stuff. And it's intense. And there's, I think, fun to be had in that intensity. So I, for one, when they go into that one village at night after the big bomb explosion. I was thinking of like a Jason Bourne movie during mm-hmm. that stretch where one of the members of their team kind of gets kidnapped and they're like kind of running through to find him and get him back. And so I wondered if you had any thoughts about how those sort of visceral thrills work or should work in a war movie, especially one that's this timely, this contemporary. Should we be having fun in movies about war?
Well, I think the adrenaline rush, I mean, it kind of goes along with some of the A.O. Scott from the New York Times called this style of movie, or Catherine Bigelow's style, hyperbolic realism. Like realism, but then like amped up even harder. You know, is your eyesight so jostly as the cameras are sometimes when, you know, it's like the handheld? Maybe they're trying to make it even more realistic. I guess it's one of those paradoxes that we have about war. That's why there's so many war movies. I have not seen every single one that's ever been made. But I think that when we're holding both of these things in our minds at once, where one, it's kind of like what kids sometimes fantasize about, like they're going to pretend to be playing army. And mm-hmm. there's so many video games to give the thrill of going around a corner and, you know, sort of having this adrenaline rush. But yet also, you know, war is horrible. It ruins many lives on at home and at the war front. So I think that the fact that we have some fun with a war movie, when the movie then turns up, you know, helps to disrupt that and say like, wait a minute, why are you having fun with this? That's what, again, makes it kind of disturbing, but in a good way. It's very thought-provoking.
Do you think that this movie does that?
Not as much as some war movies that I've seen.
I almost think about Jarhead, because Jarhead is kind of about how we train our soldiers to crave that pink mist. You know, they're all chasing that pink mist. They're snipers. They want to, you know, basically means that you just killed somebody.
Yeah.
And you're waiting around for that. The whole movie is about waiting. And by the time that thing happens, there's a consequence that you weren't intending that comes along with that. And so you have like this fantasy reality divide. This movie, I don't think it ever sort of says, let's have fun with this.
And I agree.
And then it pulls the curtain and then makes you kind of face your own.
I don't think it's nearly trying to have as much fun as like the Jason Bourne effect that you're talking about. I will say though, that probably the most uncomfortable I felt in the whole movie, and maybe it's because some of the other bloody stuff is deleted from my version since I watched this edited, but when they're beating each other up and punching each other in the barracks, that felt like so real and so uncomfortable. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's like, why do people do this? You know, and it reminded me of like, you know, when it gets too rough in like a locker room, you know, playing in high school baseball or, you know, things like that, where there's like real, the borderline between brotherly love and like hatred sometimes is just blurred. You have a brother.
Yeah. And there's a line between hatred and it's paper thin, Brian.
If you're listening. So yeah, Jeremy Renner, he said when they were filming, because they're like in Jordan, is it? Mm.
I'm not sure.
In Jordan and Kuwait is where they filmed. They wanted to be super close. They're 3 miles away from the border. And Catherine Bigelow was, first of all, she cast relatively unknown people. Jeremy Renner was not a big deal at that time.
It's funny, and now him and
they're both in on the Avengers, you know. So, yeah. She said the lack of familiarity brings a sense of unpredictability. Mm-hmm. So, like, you don't know if Jeremy Renner is really like, he always plays a good guy, you know. So, I think that worked in that way, but Renner also said this: we got shot at a few times while we were filming. When you see it, you're going to feel like you've been in a war.
Hmm.
Do you feel like you've been in a war? Again, compared to what other movies, but I have not been in a war, so I can't really say.
I'm not sure that it felt that immersive, but that intensity, that fun factor that I was talking about, I think that in most war movies, I would have a problem with that, where it's sort of like, we're going to have our cake and eat it too, or we're going to sort of criticize war and say how bad it is, but then you're also going to have fun while you're watching this movie, which is kind of, you know. But this movie, if war is drug, then we kind of have to understand what the appeal of that drug is.
Which and is?
Adrenaline, that rush. And that's what Jeremy Renner is chasing, feeling, scene after scene. The high stakes.
Feeling important. Feeling important. As opposed to the grocery store scene.
Yes, for sure. And so, I don't know. I think that's kind of the curtain being pulled back moment where you realize that there's no end to this. You know, if it's just, you know, you're chasing a dragon the whole time, you're just going to end back right where you started, and that's what the movie does.
The ending scene was a real, I've mentioned this before on other episodes, but it was definitely an eye opener to me, because I've been like, you know, reading all these film books and how the character goes on the journey and it's a different person at the end. And what did they learn on the journey? What does Jeremy Renner learn on this journey?
I think he is a different person from the end. We just didn't see who he was initially. We start in the story after he'd already been in war and what diffused, he said like over 800 bombs or so.
Do you think he's telling the truth there?
I have no idea.
I didn't know either. I was okay not knowing, but I thought that was an interestingly, you know, specific answer he gave.
It was,
He doesn't seem like the kind of person who would actually keep track.
Yeah, then again, he does have a little container where he keeps keepsakes from like his favorite
of them.
Bombs. Yeah, that's true. But I don't know. I think that you do have that arc here, in that, you know, I'm sure at the beginning of this war, he was thinking, I can get back to my normal life at the end of it. And then you realize that that's not what you want anymore. And your priorities have changed and you've become a different person in this process. And your brain chemistry has changed, like I was saying early on, just because you're addicted to this thing.
I didn't really get the sense that countdown to how many days left they had. I thought that, you know, it's an interesting device. Mm-hmm. I could see where Eldridge, the guy who, you know, is having the therapy sessions and everything, he probably is counting down. Maybe Anthony Mackie's character is.
Yeah.
I didn't really get the sense that Jeremy Renner was really counting down, like he couldn't wait to get home.
No.
In fact, being home is kind of uncomfortable, which again is a lot of war movies are kind of like this, where it's, you know, I kind of thought that the grocery store scene was a little bit cliche.
Really?
I mean, the idea of, you know, here I am stuck in the grocery store and how boring is it? But I couldn't really come up with all the other examples of where you saw that. So I almost didn't say it. But
I just don't know how long he's been there. And I get the impression that he's been there for a very long time, because right when he joins this team, he's already brash and kind of throwing caution to the wind and doing things in a way that's not according to their, you know, their policies or doctrines or whatever.
To me, when he's at the, when you see him going back into war with the suit on, it kind of was an example of, this is a character who does not change. Hmm. He's the same guy at the beginning as he is at the end. And in a way, I feel like that's kind of like breaking all the rules of narrative, but it was kind of like thrilling at the end to see that. Like there's something about him that maybe sort of, it's not like you're rooting for him to go back to war necessarily, but there is something about like, I'm good at this. This is really who I am. He's found out who he was basically. And it's this warrior.
But still, I might push back against that a little bit, because I'm not sure that that is who he was until he got there. And then,
but how old is he?
I don't know.
22 years old or something?
But if we're talking addiction, then the whole sort of idea is that this substance, whatever that might be, changes the way that you think. It changes the way that you that you exist. So he could have just been a guy doing boring guy things and then wound up here. And then after a while, it's like that's your baseline, and everything below that just seems pointless.
Do you think he had ever got into a punching match like he did with in the barracks?
Maybe he was a football player in high school. Who knows?
By the way, the best actor this year was won by Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart.
I still haven't watched Crazy Heart.
The other nominees were Colin Firth for A Single Man, George Clooney, Up in the Air, Morgan Freeman, Invictus, and Jeremy Renner, Hurt Locker. Hmm. One more quick thing on Jeremy Renner, and that is Richard Corliss of Time wrote quite a bit about his performance. He talks about he's an ordinary, pudgy-faced, quiet, and at first seems to lack the charisma to carry a film. Did you kind of feel that way when he first shows up? I mean, he's brash, but he's like, why is this guy exactly the leader? It seems like Anthony Mackie's character could have been the leader of this group.
He's kind of the prototype of what you think about. You know, he's the tall guy in the group, He looks more like a hero. But
he's very serious.
Yes.
You know, he's like, he's going to get things done efficiently and he's going to follow the rules. So why isn't he the leader?
Well, that's part of the surprise of the movie is that this guy shows up who's kind of seemingly very casual and doesn't seem to really be fazed by everything that's going on all around him. But he's great in this. He has such a, I don't even know what the word is. I don't know.
It says
the way he carries himself.
He uses the phrase, he said, he compares, Richard Corliss compares Jeremy Renner in this movie to a young Russell Crowe. Thought that was an interesting comparison. Hmm. Didn't really think of it, but I could see that. And then he says that it's a creepy marvel to watch him in action. He has a cool aplomb, analytical acumen, and attention to detail of a great athlete or a master psychopath. Maybe both.
Hmm.
It is a fascinating character that's been created here. Maybe one of the most interesting characters of the year, you know, which is again, kind of a, you know, who are you of all the people that you've watched, you know, for 09, who are you most glued to the screen to see what is he doing next? What is he saying next?
Mm-hmm.
This character is one of them for sure.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm thinking of that scene where it's the long sniper scene where Anthony Mackie is kind of got his sights set on the house, and Renner's doing Renner things, and everybody's all dusty, and then he asks for some juice,
and you think he's gonna
drink it for himself.
And really think he was gonna drink it. Of course, he's gonna give it to his guy.
I didn't think he was gonna give it to his guy. I never even thought of it. Maybe because I would not give it to my guy. You know,
that's true.
I would just guzzle the whole thing down myself.
If I'm here and my lips are really parched, you know, they're cracking. You wouldn't give me the Capri Sun.
Not if I'm thirsty. But it does.
Is that dessert drink or is that like breakfast drink?
That's not even a drink. I mean, if you're drinking a Capri Sun and you're not either in the desert or a child.
You're hydrating.
I don't know. Sugar drink. But that does give you another layer about this character that's interesting, you know, that he is actually a leader in that scenario. Yeah. He's not just a guy that's doing whatever he wants all the time.
He's trying to reassure the Eldridge character, like it's okay, just wipe the blood off of these bullets and it's going to be all right. Spit on him. And he's kind of walking him through it, knowing that he's pretty scared of death.
Yeah. So I have one more question for you that I don't really have an answer to myself. So I need you to answer.
I probably do.
Do you think that Bigelow is indicting the audience here at all in this movie? And I think of one key scene that I'll give you as my example. It takes place right after Renner's unit gets nighttime explosion that I talked about before, and they think that it was a suicide bomber initially. And then Renner finds the end of the blast zone where I think that there's an orange tree or something. And he realizes then, like, oh, I think actually this is probably where the bomber was standing. Mm-hmm. They were watching this whole thing happen from far enough away to kind of, you know, be safely out of reach. And then at that point, all three men point their flashlights toward the camera, which is supposed to be kind of like in the woods. Mm-hmm. And Renner says something like, a good bad guy would watch from the dark. And that's when they go into the woods to try to find that guy.
So I, the audience member, am the bad guy watching from the dark.
Watching from the dark, yeah. And I was trying to figure out, are there other times, other places in this movie where that point is made? I'm not really sure.
Hmm.
Am I looking too much into it?
No, I think anytime that the people are looking right at the camera and they're talking about, make a comment like that. I missed that in the, when I watched it. So that's a good discovery. Is she implicating the viewer? I think that she has done a lot of disturbing stuff. You know, Zero Dark 30 is pretty brutal. We're like, we're watching people get tortured and, you know, how much are we okay with this? And I don't really get the sense that she's pointing any fingers though. I think that she is, like a lot of great artists, trying to hold two very difficult things in her hands at the same time and trying to get us to do the same thing and wrestle with, you know, well, it without really talking a lot about war as a big abstract concept, besides that first epigraph, war is a drug. I think that it raises a lot of questions about war without really, you know, hitting you over the head with it, even though there's a lot of bombs and blood and guts going on.
Yeah.
Did you feel implicated? Did you feel guiltily safe sitting here in your house, like you should be out there?
I think a little bit, you know, especially when our daily lives are mostly undisturbed by a war that's going on the other side of the world, so much so that you can kind of forget sometimes that there's even a war going on.
Yeah, that is true. I think that may be one of the reasons that it's important to have Jeremy Renner come home and be in those little moments. Like, he has this adorable kid. He's got a beautiful wife.
Adorable kid who loves everything and doesn't realize that as you get older, the things you love are fewer and fewer until you only love one or two.
I broke all the rules of improv by not just saying yes. And, I think when I see that scene where he's just at his normal happy life, you think, why isn't this so bad? And that's kind of what I have. So what makes me so different from him? And I don't know, it's thought provoking.
You haven't been to war. That's what makes you different.
Yeah, it's true.
And I don't clean the gutters. That's what makes me different.
That's I did clean my gutters recently. Yeah. Couple of trivia points. It averaged 120 degrees Fahrenheit in 44 days of shooting.
Man.
Anthony Mackie said, you can't fake that amount of heat. I mean, you have to be there. You can't just pretend like you're sweating.
It's true.
The bomb suit weighed 80 to 100 pounds.
Whew.
Jeremy Renner, of course, spent, you know, a few weeks wearing it around the house. Probably, no. He was like, he worked with some kind of crew. And
I would think that they would just hollow it out and make it lighter. Why does he have to wear the real thing?
This is hyperbolic realism. Can't do that. Okay, keep it or kick it.
I liked this more this time than I did the last time. Mm-hmm. And I just watched Precious recently and had a different take on that one too, which are interesting. I think that this is keepable, but for my top five, I'm just not sure. I'm always kind of in this zone with, like, I have more movies, I don't know, because I do like Jarhead a lot, but a lot of the time with war movies, with biopics, with very plotty detective stories, I can like them a lot without really ever feeling fully connected and loving them or getting excited about them. And I'm kind of here. I'm kind of there with this one where I liked it a lot more this time around, but I'm just not sure that I connected enough to say Desert Island, if I only have five from the year that I can keep, would this be one? I'm going to guess probably not by the end of the year, but I don't want that to take away from the fact that I think more highly of this now than I did when I saw it in 2009.
I'm sure that Catherine Bigelow would be very happy to hear that.
I think so.
If you're listening,
it's nice to hear.
Put a comment on the Facebook post. I'm going to say, yes, I'll keep it. I'm going to keep it. I'm going to keep it. I love the character. It's fascinating. I'm gripped throughout. And I think it's a great achievement for the year. All right, in the next episode, we are going to revisit Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire.
Until
a long title.
Until then, find us on social media or wherever you listen to podcasts. And for 16 years of Golden Takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show or help choose a bonus episode, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, one podcast that also has not made up its budget before the Oscars.